think it's so humbling to kind of witness that, to see, after a transplant that people are still trying their very best to navigate sometimes these impossible or what feels like impossible situations. Time and time again, I see people stepping up and working to, like, you see families kind of rally together and make a team effort and to support someone. And I think it's really meaningful to see that.
Welcome to the Living Transplant Podcast, where we take you behind the scenes of the transplant program at Toronto General Hospital. I'm your host, Candace. Each episode, we share the powerful stories from transplant recipients and living donors, along with insights and education from leading medical professionals. Today, we're talking about the part of chronic disease and transplant that is one of the most complex parts of the journey, mental health. For patients facing liver disease, the journey is an emotional, mental, and deeply personal one. Joining us today is Sasha Kanagarayan, a clinical social worker at Toronto's University Health Network, where she supports patients in the alcohol liver disease program. Sasha is on the front lines of transplant care, helping patients navigate the psychological weight of uncertainty, stigma, and the intense emotional toll of waiting for a second chance at life. She brings a trauma-informed, compassionate lens to this work, ensuring that mental health isn't left behind in the pursuit of physical healing. In this episode, Sasha shares what it means to hold space for hope, fear, guilt, and resilience, and why caring for the mind is just as vital as caring for the body on the path to transplant. Welcome back to the Living Transplant Podcast. It is my absolute honor and thrill to have Sasha with me today. Sasha, I'm wondering if you can introduce yourself to our audience.
Yeah, so thanks for having me. My name is Sasha. I'm a social worker with the transplant program at Toronto General. I specifically work with the alcohol liver disease program doing assessments for pre-transplant patients.
Amazing. Yeah. And let's go back a little while. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how you became a social worker and really what was your why? What kind of drove you to getting into this line of work?
Yeah. So interestingly, initially, I didn't actually want to be a social worker. I started off in psychology initially, and then I went on to do my bachelor's in social work, but it was all with the intent of being a child life specialist.
Oh, wow.
I don't know if anyone, anyone listening is familiar with like sick kids, and they have all these like child life volunteers and do a lot of medical play. So that was like my intent to pursue my master's in child life after graduation. But then I had, I started kind of doing summer jobs in the social work field. I started off with home care. And I had this really good manager and a really good team. And I got to do a lot of more social work-based work, which was more case management and supportive work and supportive counseling work and helping people kind of navigate. And I realized during that summer, maybe my third year, I think, that I actually wanted to pursue social work. And I think the main piece, my takeaway was I really liked kind of being a little footnote in people's stories. I found that, you think like the little things you say or a small referral you make, people kind of forget about it. But I realized just even in that summer, like a short 4 month summer, how like a small impact, kind of a small thing impacted people so much. And I thought that was really meaningful work. And then I joined Toronto General and I think about 2016.
Well, I'll tell you on behalf of myself or other patients too, I'm almost 16 years out now from my transplant, and I did about 18 months of dialysis, and I remember very specific things that my dialysis social worker did for me and very specific talks that I had for her. And like I, every time I see her now, I've seen her a couple times in the last few years. I thank her because she was so impactful in such a difficult time in our lives. And so to be able to have somebody who comes in with such like a warm heart and that's what they're working towards is making your journey better. It is so nice to be a patient to know we have people like you who are taking good care of us. So yes, you definitely are more than a footnote in a lot of people's journey, I'm sure. So thinking about the alcohol liver disease program, how does that program work? What is your role in that program as the social worker, and what is your impact, I guess, on patients?
Yeah, so the Alcohol Liver Disease Program specifically works with people who've consumed alcohol within the last year. And the intent of the program is really to support people post-transplant. And, making sure, they don't, we can prevent relapses or support them in, no alcohol moving forward, recognizing like any kind of addiction is a health condition, right? So my role within the team is I do a social work assessment, which is also called like a psychosocial assessment. I ask lots of intrusive questions about people's personal lives, and they're so kind to always so willingly answer these questions, which is really nice. And we do a screen around alcohol use, but more so talking about people's insight, right? I ask a lot of questions about how much did you drink, why did you drink, but with the hope that people are transparent and talking about, life stressors and life events, or maybe it was just like a social thing or the pandemic or cultural. And I hope to, in these assessments, make it a little bit more normal that people feel safe kind of speaking about these topics. I think it's super stigmatized, right? Alcohol use, especially when you now have a diagnosis of liver disease or cirrhosis or whatever it might be. I think it can be very stigmatized and overwhelming, and a lot of self-blame occurs in these assessments, I find. So I think it's, taking a step back with people and telling them the intent is not to judge, but to hear truly like what has your experience been, and how can, we now work together to ensure following transplant you don't have any kind of relapses or supported in cravings and things like that. And often that is engaging in a relapse prevention therapy program, working with my team psychiatrists or addiction specialists, and kind of working together as a team.
Amazing. And yeah, I mean, it's such a unique space to be in, with both having to deal with the stigma of alcoholism and then also the stigma of an alcohol-related liver disease. I mean, that's a big thing for the patient to face and then their families and people with them. What are some of, I guess, the pieces or like support that you provide those patients who face such unique challenges?
I think just even in the language I use when I speak to people, right? Like not using the term alcoholic, but someone who has used alcohol. Like I think not, just with the language, I think makes a big difference without using like blaming words, I think is really important. I think it's important for patients to hear that I have, I no matter what number you tell me, I've heard different numbers from every patient. So you don't need to worry about telling me the amount you've drank. I've heard that from other patients and letting them know they're not alone. And I always like tell patients you can't live life backwards, right? Like I think it's very easy to stand back after you're diagnosed of cirrhosis and say, well, I should have stopped. Or why didn't I stop? Like it's very easy to have all these answers from a distance. And I think sometimes it's just validation with patients and families. And I think, I've learned over the years that it's okay to just say to people that's really hard. Like I don't need to always have an answer or a solution. And I think that's come with time. I think starting off as a social worker, you want to like have an answer, a fix for everything. And I think the biggest support like I can provide people is just a safe space where they can speak openly, where they can cry, they can feel sad, or they can feel angry, or whatever that feeling might be from the family or patient perspective, but knowing this is a safe space to talk about this, and it's okay.
And you're right. It doesn't really matter why you're in this transplant process. You're here now. You have a transplant. How do we support you so that the rest of your transplant journey, hopefully the rest of your life, is a healthy one and one that you have all of the supports that you need? Because really, no matter what space we come from, I think, and we talk about it a lot, mental health is such a space that is hard to access. There's not a ton of resources, not a ton of finances allocated that is needed. We focus so much on physical health, and we do a pretty good job of that. You know, for myself, I make sure I take my transplant medication whenever my alarm goes off. I have family members who live with mental health and issues, and they some of them sometimes don't take their medication the same way that I do. And we've had those conversations as like, why is your medication less important in your mind than my medication for my physical body. Like you should be taking it with your alarm the same way that I do for my transplant. Right. And so, you know, learning how to navigate that and, you know, find ways that we can make sure that people have the right support through their journey, because a liver transplant, a kidney transplant, it's not a cure for our underlying health conditions. Yeah. It's just another treatment process. Yeah. Right. And with a treatment comes a lot of mental health issues that we have to deal with on top of the physical issues that we have with a transplant, right? And so having social workers like yourself who understand this and know how to navigate this for people, I think is so incredibly important.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, you know, you spoke a little bit about recovery and relapse. Can you speak to how recovery and relapse risks are incorporated into the program and how you talk to patients and families about this? And are there a lot of concerns with patients themselves once they get this transplant? Is that a fear for them?
I think for a lot of patients, the diagnosis of liver disease is a big scare and alarm for them, right? Enough that they want to stop. I think a lot of people struggle with it, right? It's easier said than done, right? A lot of people know I shouldn't be, but it's not that easy to just stop. So a lot of work, they have a similar assessment with our psychiatrist on my team, who does like a very thorough kind of alcohol use kind of assessment. We also have our addiction specialist who kind of helps with some counseling and connecting them to resources like the relapse prevention therapy program. And often we encourage everyone to participate in these programs, because even if right now you're doing well, you're not having any cravings or thoughts for alcohol, it's hard to predict what will come up in the future, right? Like things can fluctuate in our lives, right? Mm-hmm. So for patients who might worry about a relapse in the future, who aren't worried about a relapse in the future, it's still beneficial, because why not have a toolkit of all these resources?
And I mean, it's so important through our journeys to have that kind of communal support behind us. Do family and caregivers play a role in this? Do you encourage a lot of them to come to the appointments and to, you know, be part of the recovery process post-transplant?
Yeah, for my appointments, I always ask for a support person to join. If they can't, I try to book a follow-up appointment with them. I think a big piece about transplant, regardless of any kind of alcohol use, for any kind of transplant, you need to have a support person, right? Mm-hmm. Someone who's going to help you with your medications in the beginning when you're super tired and can't remember to set that alarm. Someone who's going to drive you to the appointments when you can't do that in the beginning. And just the emotional toll, right? Like, I think that's the biggest piece I hear from a patient after transplant. They didn't realize the emotional toll having another organ in their body would have on that, right? Like, I think that's the piece we kind of forget to speak about sometimes. I know I forget to speak about that in my assessments a lot, right? You get so focused on the medical pieces and the practical things about coming to your appointment and who's going to remind you about your medication, that you forget that there's this whole emotional piece to it. And I think having a support person that's available, and a support team in general, but a main person who you can like call on at any point, I think is really important. So I think having families in the beginning knowing what the expectations are really helps the patients. And then I think it shows them, like, somebody showed up for you, like they were willing to take the call from me in the middle of their work day, like that.
Yeah.
That in itself shows the patients that like they care about you and you are valuable and everyone wants you to get healthy.
And you touched on something that I talk about all the time. You know, we're in our heads, we think, okay, I've had this transplant, I am healthy now, I'm going to move on and be completely quote unquote normal. And everything's going to be great. And there's, you know, going to be no bumps along the road. Because we just expect in our head, okay, I was so sick before, I'm getting this transplant, now I'm going to be healthy, which means everything is going to be healthy. And I think it's very shocking often for a lot of us that, oh no, wait, there's a lot of bumps. I mean, especially in that first year post-transplant with the ups and downs with medication and how it impacts our mental health. And sometimes you feel like so unstable and wondering, like, is this normal? Am I normal to feel low and depressed post-transplant when I've just had the greatest gift ever? And of course, part of it is the medication that we're on. Like, it takes time to kind of balance that out in our bodies. But I'm wondering if you can talk to that, you know, the expectation that we patients sometimes have that it's going to be all of the glory and all of this, you know, majestic, beautiful post-transplant life, that, you know, sometimes we forget that there are the messy bits in between.
And for that, I try to kind of, I find patients or people in general respond to practical ideas, right? So I often talk about, like, you're going to be off of work for at least 6 months. And I think that in itself, by taking away any of the physical or mental health symptoms people may experience, by just saying, like, okay, you're not going to be able to go to work for a certain amount of months. You're not going to be able to drive your car for a certain amount of months, kind of starts to put things into perspective for people. And I always tell people, maybe I'm wrong about these timelines, but if I'm not wrong, then you need to be planning ahead for this and thinking about this. And so hopefully by people starting to have these kinds of potential changes to expect, it helps them a little bit when they do incur these little bumps. And what's really nice with my team is they get follow-up from the psychiatrist, so they get to see somebody post-transplant, as well as an extra layer of support for the more mental health pieces. And I remain, like, I follow people lifelong, but it's, I find my work is a lot more around this case management. I still can't draw, like, these more practical day-to-day things that I think can get forgotten in the healthcare system, right? Because again, we get so focused on, did you show up for your appointment? And did you take your medications? But everyone kind of forgets there's still bills to pay. There's still kids to be taken care of, parents who need rides places. There's still a social life that you're maybe missing dinners or missing a vacation. There's all these other pieces. I think kidney is one of the few organs that, like, have a specific dedicated, like, foundation where they can access peer support programs. Like, there's nothing like that really for livers. I think in an ideal world, there is more support groups pre-transplant and post-transplant for all ages, right? For the kids, for the caregivers, for the patient, and just even just general mental health and coping for everyone, right? Because it has an impact on the whole family and friend group and everyone's. I think having free access to this, right? Like, a lot of times, unless you have private insurance, the quickest way to access mental health supports, it's really difficult, right? There's wait lists for everything.
And you touched on something so important there. You know, we have the Transplant Ambassador Program, we have the Kidney Foundation. Through the center, we have a lot of volunteers that can provide all of that peer mentorship and support for those kidney patients who are going through their journey from the time you're diagnosed. And, you know, maybe your kidney function is still really good and you have no symptoms and you're years away from dialysis, but you can still talk to somebody who is living with reduced kidney function, who may eventually sometime in their life need dialysis, or you could talk to a dialysis patient, or you could talk to a transplant patient. Like, there are monthly group sessions where people go in and there's specific topics. Like, there is one for parents caring for children who have reduced kidney function. Like, there's so much peer support in the kidney world. And I think you're right. We hosted a Finding a Living Donor session last year in Ottawa, and the majority of people who showed up were liver patients, and they said, we just want to talk to each other. Like, we don't know how to connect with one another. There aren't these big social networks that we can go to and, you know, sit online once a month that have been organized by people. So often they'll go to social media or Facebook groups or the worst doctor of all, Dr. Google, to find things, right? So I think you're right there, that peer support, to have somebody say, I've done this myself, I've been through it, here's a couple things that might help you along the way. It's so impactful.
And that's one of the most common things I hear in my assessments when I say, oh, I've heard that before from another patient. You know, when someone makes a statement and I say, oh, well, I don't think you're alone in that. Like, I think that's pretty common for the patients that I see to feel that way or to think that, or even kind of giving the same response to families. And the most common response I hear back is, wow, that's really nice to know. I'm not the only one who's thinking this. I'm not the only one who's feeling this. Oh, I thought I was like being silly or being weird by thinking this, right? I think it, and that's the most common thing I hear in any of these assessments, that wow, I'm not the only one. They really do feel alone, and it can be a very isolating experience. Like in your friend group, you might be the only one who's now not going to work and stuck at home, going to all these appointments. Like it can feel very isolating. A lot of things are changing for you.
And you're right. I mean, like when I was diagnosed, I was a crash start. So we didn't know that I had kidney disease until I was in the hospital, you know, needing dialysis. And I was 24 at the time. So none of my peers were experiencing any kind of health issues. Like everyone was young and healthy and finishing their degrees and, you know, traveling to Asia and all over the world, right? And I was sitting in a hospital bed for 3 weeks, and then I was dialyzing three times a week at the hospital, and then eventually went home and I would dialyze 9 hours a night. And so I would miss things like bonfires, or, you know, one day I had, there was my friend was having a birthday party, and I decided to go to a zoo with my sister and her son, because I was like, of course, that sounds so much fun. But I was outside and it was hot all day. And, you know, it took a lot of walking. And by the time I got home, I was pooped and I slept until like 11 o'clock at night. Woke up and thought, oh my gosh, I'm, you know, I don't have the energy to go to that birthday party. And of course they understood. They were like, of course, stay home, like relax. We'll see you anytime. But in my head, it was such a big deal. Like I wanted to be there, not just for the birthday friend, but like I needed to be there for my mental health as well. Like just to feel like a regular 20-year-old. But there were all of these things that, you know, when you have a chronic illness that are taken away from what you would call like a normal healthy lifestyle that you now have to deal with. And I think those are, you often think about the big milestones about what somebody is delaying or what somebody is missing, like that, you know, graduating university or getting married or having a child, you think of big milestones. But whenever I talk to people who live in this chronic illness place or this chronic disease space, it's always the little milestones that really kind of kick you in the butt, like those missing the birthday parties or needing a nap in the middle of the day. So you miss, you know, going on a road trip or, you know, you have a dialysis session. So going to the cottage, it just isn't something that is easy to do, or, you know, all, or even eating. Thinking about a big family dinner, what somebody is going to bring to dinner. Can I eat what's going to be there? Do I need to bring a tiny Tupperware of my own, you know, salt-free, low potassium, low phosphorus food, right? Like it's, it really is, I find, less the big milestones and more the little things that impact you, which I think when you're outside of that realm, you think it would be the opposite.
No, the little things are definitely, I find, the most important.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You're right. It's the day-to-day things. It's the big things you can plan for, right? Like if someone is having a wedding, you can plan ahead. You can do your research. You can make sure you have your rest. You can do your best to plan for that. But it's the things that people kind of, other people might take for granted, right? Like missing a party to anyone else, maybe like, well, there's going to be another one. Like, you can see them next weekend for dinner instead, right? But for you or the person who's missing it, that's, and at, you know, different ages, everyone's going through different things. Like someone who, you know, we're talking about you who's younger, but I can think about my patients who are getting ready to retire. Well, I guess I'm just stuck in Ontario now, right? Like, so I think it's all these like little things, right? Like, can I travel to visit my new grandchild? Can I hold them when I have the lifting restrictions? Can I walk my new dog right away? Right? Like all these like little things that, it seems so typical, but they're so important.
And you brought up finances and retirement. Those two things. I knew a gentleman who he had someone step forward to donate a kidney to him, and he was incredibly excited. And one of the gentlemen who was dialyzing beside him said, like, oh, are you going to retire now? You know, you live this amazing, happy, healthy life and off you go. And he said, no, I'm going back to work now. Like I've delayed my retirement because I've been on dialysis for a couple of years. So I wasn't making the kind of income that I needed. to retire at the time that I thought. And that was another reality that I, you know, that I didn't think about is, like you said, that income that we miss out when we're sick and when we can't go to work, or maybe we're doing reduced amount of work, right? All of these little things that impact the world that that we live in.
And I think with that, it just, I try to, like, some for some people might feel very negative, but I try to be very honest, right? Like the government programs that are going to be available to you, if you were working full-time, it may not be enough, right? It's not going to be equivalent, right? And what's provided by the government doesn't necessarily equal to what's actually needed from a, like, a living standpoint after transplant or in general, right? So I think sometimes it's that honesty with patients, and, you know, sometimes they leave like, what am I going to do? And I'm like, but I'd rather you have that, I don't know what I'm going to do, so we can process and try to make a plan, versus afterwards, because it's so important to think about these things, right? Like, finances impacts every aspect of your life.
I mean, we talk about heavy things often on this podcast, and it often feels like if you are on social media or listening to news, it's not the lightest, you know, we're not hearing a lot about puppy dogs and rainbows in the world right now. I'm wondering what gives you hope, in the world, hope in the work that you do, and joy in some of this that you focus on.
I think that it's very humbling. Like, I think people face these very adverse situations, pre-transplant, even post-transplant, navigating whatever the barriers or challenges might be, that's physical, mental health, family, staff, friends, like social. Like, I find it so humbling that people are able to do it. And it, like, I mean, like, I feel like a patient might say to me, well, what other choice did I have?
Right.
But I think there was another choice. You could have said you could have not pursued the transplant, right? As bad as that sounds, like, there was another option. And I think it's so humbling to kind of witness that, to see, you know, after a transplant, that people are still trying their very best to navigate sometimes these impossible or what feels like impossible situations. To me, I'm like, oh my goodness, like, what are you, how are you going to fix this? How are we going to work through this? And they are, right? And it's the families at the bedside, right, who are showing up and who are compassionate, and they're engaging with the team in whatever way, right? If that's speaking to the nurse or following up with me on behalf of the patient, like, it's just so humbling to just see that. Because it's, you know, when you go through, like, I think it can be easy to kind of just be like, this is too much,
right?
From a family, like, this is too much. Sure. Like, I can't do it. And time and time again, I see people stepping up and working to, like, you see families kind of rally together and make a team effort and to support someone. And I think it's really meaningful to see that.
Amazing. If we had, you know, 2 minutes in our day and we're feeling overwhelmed, or we're feeling low that day, is there a, like, a 2 minute social worker pep talk type thing we could do for ourselves, or something that, you know, we could actively engage in to kind of try to, you know, make our day a little bit better? Do you have any of those, you know, hot, quick tips?
I mean, I think it's different for everybody, right? Like, for some people, it's just a quick listen to a song that you really like as a distraction. For some people, it's calling a friend or sending a text. For some people, it's self-affirmation thoughts, right? Like, reminding yourself about the positives. And I think it's also okay to not feel okay.
Yeah.
Like, I think that's the, in those 2 minutes of distress, like, I think it's okay to be like, well, this is really not so good. And and it's okay to sit with that discomfort. Like, I think it's okay for people to sit with discomfort. And, you know, I think the question is, how do you move through that? And I think that's a much bigger conversation, right? Because everyone's so, so different. But I think I would tell people, you're not alone. And there are supports available, if that's within your medical team or your friend group or your personal group, maybe your work group, or people belong to different religious or community groups. Like, it, there are different things to explore, and sometimes you can feel stuck, right? And that's why it's so important to have good relationships with your healthcare team and your family doctors or whoever that might be for you, so you can have these conversations.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining us today on the podcast. We're so grateful to have somebody like you on our team and somebody like you that is supporting people going through these really difficult times. So thank you for what you do in your day-to-day life and also for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Living Transplant Podcast. If you did, please rate, leave us a review, and share with your friends. Don't forget to subscribe to Living Transplant wherever you're listening today. If you have any ideas for podcast episodes, please reach out to us at livingorgandonation@uhn.ca. For information about living organ donation, you can visit us at www.livingorgandonation.ca. Special thanks to Bespoke Productions for editing this episode and for production support. I'm your host, Candace Coughlin. Thanks for spending your time with us.